Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who used to be the senior editor of the New American Magazine. And now, of course, he is has his own blog, has his own radio program on the weekend. And certainly, if you don't listen to William, why, you're missing something. He's certainly one of the most brilliant people we have, keeping us up to date on so many of the issues that are taking place. And you'll find his articles very, very frequently quoted at LouRockwell.com, at NewsWithViews.com, WorldAffairsBrief.com. Certainly he is recognized, I think, across the country as one of the more astute minds that we have out there on our side, trying to clarify what the issues are. So without further ado, let's go to William Grigg. Hi, William. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Thanks again for having me as a guest on your program.
Well, it's always good to have you, and what are we going to be talking about this evening?
I think we're going to have to talk a little bit more about a depressing but unavoidable topic, and that is the Carthaginian destruction of our middle-class economy. And we hot on the tails of the G20 summit in Toronto, which was police state pageantry at its most vacuous and pointless. And the thing that I find most remarkable about this, and this is something that many people have commented on, but I think bears repetition, is the fact that you had the European contingent, primarily Merkel from Germany, talking about the need for austerity, and the American contingent, led by Obama, talking about the supposed need for Keynesian stimulus. And we've been barraged now over the last 5 or 6 days with unambiguous warnings from people who are credentialed insider establishmentarian folks, Paul Krugman among them, that we're not seeing a double dip. We're not seeing a recovery. What we're seeing is that the economy is in free fall and is yet to hit bottom. Krugman has actually used the D word, depression, to describe what's underway right now. And when something is so obvious, so glaringly obvious that even Paul Krugman understands and recognizes what's going on, we know that we're in deep, deep trouble, because Mr. Krugman has been a Leibnizian positivist in terms of trying to tell everybody that this is the best of all possible worlds, what's going on in our economy with the government spending literally trillions of dollars that it doesn't have and that the Federal Reserve has to conjure out of the ether, that this is what has to be done in order to rescue the economy. And he's saying that this isn't working and that the buck is coming up empty. That being said, I think that the most important thing we can do is look at the ways that our own robber elite, our own criminal oligarchy, what the Soviets call the nomenklatura, is doing the same kind of things that the Soviet communist nomenklatura did when their empire imploded back in the late 80s and early 1990s. This is a theme that we've talked about before, but it's really important to get into some of the mechanics of this huge enterprise in political larceny, just by way of letting people know what's going on so that they can try to avoid some of the obvious pitfalls. If your listeners go to LouRockwell.com and look at Friday's edition, I believe the Saturday edition is already up. If it isn't up yet, it doesn't look like it is, it will be up within a couple of minutes. They usually go online at about 9 o'clock California time or 10 o'clock my time with the following day's edition for every day except for Sunday. The fourth article down from the top is an essay I wrote dealing with this unambiguous criminal state that rules us right now and the way that it is almost impossible for somebody who is charged with some of these obscure...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, William, go right ahead. You were saying somebody who is plagued with this obscure what now?
Yeah. these obscure federal banking regulations who has done nothing wrong, nothing criminal, to elude some kind of punishment, no matter how innocuous his behavior might be. But there is literally nothing that the criminal class on Wall Street can do by way of deliberate fraud or deliberate persistent conscious theft and malfeasance, nothing that people who are politically connected on Wall Street can do that will end up meriting some kind of punitive sanction. In other words, there basically is a situation where there are two classes of people. There are those whom the law doesn't protect and those whom the law doesn't restrain. That's what Paul Craig Roberts likes to say. But there are those who are too big to fail, and there are those, the rest of us, who are too small to be permitted to succeed. And the juxtaposition that I offer in this essay, which is entitled Clemency for Wall Street Criminals, Prison for the Powerless, deals with the case of Johnny Gaskins from Raleigh, North Carolina. Now, not many people have heard of Johnny Gaskins. I hadn't heard of him before several months ago. I think it would have been October or November of last year when Dr. William Anderson, who's an economist from Maryland and he's an adjunct scholar with the Ludwig von Mises Institute, wrote an essay about his case. He's a criminal defense lawyer from Raleigh, North Carolina, not a particularly notable one, even in that very small pond. He's one of the less conspicuous minnows in that small pond. But he's made a living, and a fairly handsome one, by defending people who are the outliers in the criminal justice system. He's rendering a legitimate public service as an officer of the bar by defending those who are accused of crime. Most of them have something to do with narcotics. That's simply the way that the system is structured right now, is that most of the business of the criminal justice system has to do with petty drug users and small market, down market dealers. And most of his business was conducted in cash because the type of people he was representing generally don't have bank accounts for reasons that Gaskins would come to understand and sympathize with. He secreted his earnings in a safe at his house. And while he was having remodeling work done on his house, he noticed that there was a series of muddy footprints leading up to the wall safe, which he thought was a secret. And so worried that somebody was going to break open his wall safe and steal his earnings, with great reluctance, Gaskins went to a local branch of a bank where he had a business account and started depositing his earnings a little bit at a time. Now, we're dealing with hundreds of thousands of dollars that he had earned over a 25-year career. And so he deposited his earnings bit by bit in increments of less than $10,000 because deposits over $10,000 under the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970 have to be reported to the IRS. Now, it's important to point out...
Hold that thought here, and of course, William is talking about a case somewhere in the South where a gentleman was a defense attorney and worked with a lot of disreputable people and said he was paid by them for his defense work. But he had a good deal of cash he'd accumulated over a period of years. Apparently, at least according to the article I read, he had paid his income tax on this money. He just didn't put it in the bank because he didn't trust banks. And then, of course, something happened as far as some repair work at his home. He thought perhaps the money he was keeping there wouldn't be safe. So he began depositing this in the banks in increments less than $10,000. Now, if you do that, that is known as structuring. If you deposit over $10,000, the bank by law is forced to report you to the government. In fact, if you were to take a large sum of money from your bank account and you were to wire it to another bank, your bank would report you. And, of course, they cannot tell you. They would go to prison if they were to tell you that they reported you, but they're required by law to report you. However, if you deposit less than $10,000, they also will report you because they will report you if you deposit more than $10,000 because you might be laundering drug money. If you report deposit less than $10,000, you could be so-called structuring, which means you're trying to avoid being reported to the government. So this is apparently what this gentleman did. Mm-hmm. The money was legal. It was his. It paid taxes on it. You pick up the story.
Exactly. It paid taxes on it, and he'd reported his income to the IRS, every penny of it. And so he was structuring money, but he was not doing so for the purpose of maintaining the opacity of his financial dealings, which incidentally, in a free society, would be a de minimis requirement for doing financial transactions. If you were anything like, oh, a reasonably free society like Switzerland, which is freer than we are for all of its imperfections, you wouldn't have to be dealing with this because it would be understood that that money is yours and it's none of the government's business, quite frankly. But in this quasi-totalitarian society that we've become, you're reported if you deposit more than $10,000 at a time. And as you point out, that's something that cannot be disclosed to you, but can only be disclosed to our masters in Washington. And you're reported if you deposit several amounts less than $10,000. So either way, your transactions are completely transparent to the federal government. In this case, Mr. Gaskins was structuring money to accomplish an innocuous end. He simply wanted to avoid certain entanglements and certain risks that came from depositing that much money at one fell swoop. And one of his big concerns, and this, of course, is essentially what happened to him anyway, was the possibility that if he deposited a large amount of money and it came to the knowledge of the local federal prosecutors, because he had made life miserable for the prosecutors by actually putting up a defense for many of the people they were throwing in prison. He, for instance, had made enemies out of the local prosecutors and the local police hierarchy because it exposed police corruption. He might be framed for doing something by way of a financial transaction with a drug nexus. And so he was doing what he did as a self-defense measure, a self-preservation measure, but it availed him nothing because those transactions were reported. And in spite of the fact that there was not a predicate offense, there was no crime anterior to the deposits from which the deposits were the proceeds, and that's something supposedly required by the Bank Secrecy Act, Gaskins ended up being tried, prosecuted, convicted of money structuring, and he faces 30 years in prison for the supposed offense of depositing his legitimately earned money on which he paid taxes in a bank account and doing so in a way that was above board and had absolutely no criminal subtext or criminal intent. But you don't have to have criminal intent in order to be considered a felon. I mean, as it's been pointed out by Harvey Silverglate in his book of this title, each of us probably commits 3 federal felonies a day. At any time, any one of us can be prosecuted for any of the harmless things that we do that are not an offense against life, liberty, property, or even decent public order because of the way that the federal laws are structured. We literally exercise whatever badly degenerated liberties that we still retain by the grace of the state that rules us. It's a little, and I've said this before, but it bears repeating once again, it's a little like the situation with the law of Moses in ancient Israel. The reason why the law was given to ancient Israel was to impress upon the minds of those living under the law that it's impossible to be righteous as measured by the law. We violate the law every single day, practically with everything we do. That's God's standard of righteousness. The Christian message is that God's standard of righteousness was consummated in the person of Christ. Well, in this case, we've got a state that claims divinity, and it's run by people who consider themselves to be divine, and they've wrapped us in such an all-encompassing cocoon of regulations and enactments that we simply cannot in any way live life in some simulacrum of freedom without violating at least 3 federal statutes every day. So any of us at any time could end up being treated like Johnny Gaskins. But that's only half of the story. The fact that this happened in North Carolina is something that was brought to my memory as we saw some disclosures this week, tardy disclosures over a deal that had been struck with Wachovia last March by federal prosecutors in that same state of North Carolina, Wachovia, until it was consumed by Wells Fargo back in 2008 in a federally engineered merger that was subsidized by the taxpayers and brought about because Wachovia, like so many other large banks, investment banks, was sitting on a moldering pile of completely useless, rotting debts. Before it was absorbed, it was headquartered in North Carolina. And you have the same federal prosecutor corps, basically, that had presided over or been in some way involved in sending Mr. Gaskins to prison. I don't think he's been sent to prison yet. I think his sentencing is still pending. But in any case, railroading him through a kangaroo court and convicting him on spurious charges of money structuring. But the same federal prosecutors exceeded previous records in sycophancy and badly misplaced clemency by granting Wachovia concessionary terms in a plea bargain agreement this past March, when it was disclosed that they had been laundering a sum of probably $300 billion, that's $300 billion with a B, for Mexican narcotics syndicates, since at least 2005 and probably further back than that. $300 billion they're required to pay a criminal forfeiture of $110 million, which is just a farthing compared to what they what we can document they laundered, and then a fine of $50 million, which, of course, is going to come out of the taxpayers' pockets. They were given, tens of billions of dollars by the taxpayers by way of this merger that was arranged with Wells Fargo. That money, of course, is fungible, the TARP money that was used to bring about this merger. So we're basically paying the penalty here, and the people running Wachovia, rather than facing criminal prosecution, simply are having the taxpayers indemnify their penalty, which was a trivial penalty to begin with as far as they were concerned. It's not so trivial when you're talking about the fact that we're on the hook for it. And they're going to be left unmolested in exchange for promises of future good behavior. Johnny Gaskins wasn't given that kind of a deal, and bear in mind, he wasn't laundering money for anybody. He was simply depositing his honestly earned and taxable income that he had duly reported as a dutiful tax slave, tax victim. He reported that income to the IRS. He wasn't allowed to forfeit a percentage that would be pennies on the dollar of that money and then make a promise of good faith. They went after him hammer and tongs, and they went after Wachovia for the purpose of just simply moving this embarrassment off of the headlines and getting it below the fold of the newspapers. But Wachovia, I happen to think, it was the fourth largest bank, or the self-described fourth largest bank until its merger with Wells Fargo. I think that you have to look at it as a criminal enterprise, certainly for the purposes of the RICO statute, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization statute, which, by the way, if I remember correctly, was passed the same year as the Bank Secrecy Act, which was violated by admission in the plea agreement. Wachovia violated that same Bank Secrecy Act that Johnny Gaskins now is going to be the reason why he's sent to prison. That, the RICO Act was passed in 1970. The idea is that if you can show a material act of crime that is being carried out by an organization, it's a conscious, culpable criminal act, then you can charge every element of that organization's labors and activities as a separate element of the crime. And so you've got this huge investment bank that was involved in this immense money laundering operation for Mexican criminal syndicates, while at the same time they were also conducting really nasty, vicious business with people who were running telemarketing frauds. And that was a separate issue that was resolved a couple of years ago. They ended up paying a fine of, I think, about $110 million. That seems to be sort of the standard amount here. We'll ding you $110 million, which is just basically what you can find rummaging around in your upholstery if you're the people running Wachovia. And, of course, you have your hand in taxpayers' pockets as well. But back in February 2008, according to the New York Times, Wachovia's corporate leadership solicited businesses, it was revealed that it had solicited business from companies it knew to be involved in telemarketing schemes. Internal Wachovia email messages, for example, show that high-ranking employees frequently warned colleagues about telemarketing frauds routed through its accounts. Wachovia had been given specific warnings from investigators and also from other banks with which they were doing business regarding these scams, yet, as the Times reports, it continued to provide banking services to multiple companies that helped steal as much as $400 million from unsuspecting victims. There was a federal civil lawsuit, a class action suit that was filed against Wachovia that accused the bank of accepting fraudulent unsigned checks that withdrew funds from the accounts of victims, often the elderly. It forwarded those checks to other banks that were unaware of the frauds, which in turn sent the money on to the swindlers. They were being a pass-through in this huge fraud that swindled hundreds of millions of dollars from people, and they didn't face any criminal penalty for what they did.
Well, unfortunately, we live in a wicked society that has no basis at all in justice. It's who you know. You know, if you know the right people, you get off. And if you don't know the right people or they target you, they'll make your life miserable. And when you take God out of a nation, when you take morality out of a nation, a sense of right or wrong, why should we be surprised when these things are happening? And no nation can survive for long if this persists. William, go right ahead.
I just recently read a quote by Lord Acton, Henry Dahlberg Acton, I believe is his name. He was the one who most famously said that power tends to corrupt and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. But he often predicted, or actually, on one occasion rather, he predicted that civilization's final battle would be between the people and the banks. And he was saying this back in the early, mid-19th century, and it proved to be prophetic in the same sense that Thomas Jefferson's warnings about banking establishment are proven to be prophetic. And this business with Wachovia is a perfect example of this. The reason why Wachovia was willing to do what it did, which is to say abetting and clearly facilitating this huge swindle of, carried out by these telemarketing frauds, these fraudulent telemarketing companies. This is going on, of course, at a time when the gushers were running, the Federal Reserve was pumping what it calls liquidity into the investment markets, and people simply had too much easy credit, too much money they didn't know what to do with. You had scams of this sort proliferate throughout the system. That's what happens when you have an engineered boom of this sort. But one of the reasons why Wachovia was doing this, in spite of the fact that they must have known that at some point this would come out, as a matter of fact, way back in 2005, there was a Wachovia executive who warned in detail about what was going on, and in her email, she said, there's a lot more, but nothing more I want to put into a note. In other words, she knew that she was sitting on top of a huge criminal conspiracy, and she was being circumspect about what she would say or what she would write for the record. But one of the reasons why Wachovia was willing to be involved in this is because they were making profits on both ends of the transaction. You know, they were making profits when they were facilitating the transactions, and then the bank was able to charge the fraud artists a large fee every time a victim spotted the bogus transaction and demanded a refund. In other words, they were able to charge a fee on the initial transaction, then charge a penalty when the bogus transactions were being taken off the books. Of course, this didn't happen as often as it should have, because if it had happened every time, which is really the standard we're looking at, or nearly every time, that fraud would have been shut down cold. But one of the companies involved in this fraud paid Wachovia over $1 million, $1.5 million in less than a year. That's just one of scores of companies involved in this. They're talking about a fraud that's almost half of $1 trillion. There's a Wachovia executive by the name of Linda Pera, P-E-R-A, who admitted in a memo, "We are making a ton of money from them." She's referring to a company later accused of stealing $142 million through fraud. That's just another example of what Wachovia was involved in before their merger. And there are other issues as well. There are plenty of lawsuits that were filed having to do with mortgage fraud and embezzlement and other kinds of deliberate criminal misbehavior on the part of this bank. All of this was going on and known to the feds by early 2008, and you had lawsuits that were filed and that were being looked at by courts in early 2008, and a few months later, you had the federal government, rather than shutting Wachovia down and starting to prosecute people who are responsible for all this misbehavior, they had the taxpayers bail them out through this merger with Wells Fargo. And I'm worried about that for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that I do have some money.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan Sinner. We were just talking about the fact that Wachovia had been involved in all sorts of nefarious programs and Frank swindles where people were losing large sums of money and they knew about this, but they were getting a percentage of the take. But the federal government also knew about this criminal activity on the part of Wachovia and did absolutely nothing about it. In fact, when Wachovia got in some financial problems, why, the federal government bailed them out with our tax money, and all of the criminal activity carried out by the Wachovia employees was simply totally forgotten, and they got off scot-free. Whereas some poor guy who's simply makes the mistake of taxing, depositing money less than $10,000 at a time because he doesn't want to draw attention to himself because of the Internal Revenue Service, why he is going to be sent to jail for 30 years. And what was his crime? Well, he should have just put all the money in at one time and hope he'd get without drawing attention to himself. And yet the money was legal. It had been paid taxes on. It was simply because he made the mistake of keeping his money at a bank at a safe at home rather than putting it in the bank initially. But go right ahead.
It's too bad he couldn't have found some other arrangement, maybe involving a numbered account in Switzerland or some other country where there is a modicum of freedom and a certain proper respect for the secrecy and sanctity of one's legitimately earned wealth. That's not the case here in this corporate socialist fascist monstrosity that America has become. McCulvey, as I mentioned before, was forced to sign an agreement, a plea agreement in March, having to do with laundering an estimated $300 billion or more of money for narcotics cartels in Mexico. And, of course, this is going on at the same time that the federal government was pumping billions of dollars into Mexico through the Merida Initiative, supposedly to fight the scourge of Mexican narcotics trafficking. What that amounts to is a roundabout subsidy for the same narcotics cartels because they're run by the government. There is a strict and almost in detail absolute identity between the Mexican government and the Mexican underworld. It's the most remarkably pure example of what Augustine talks about in the City of God. I believe it's Book 4, Chapter 4 of the City of God, where St. Augustine talked about the fact that the way that a government historically has been created is that a band of robbers attains sovereignty over a piece of territory, and that the transition from being a robber band to being a government takes place not when they repudiate violence, but rather when they establish impunity. They can no longer be punished for their violence. They can no longer face accountability when they steal from people or they threaten people or they kill people. That's the difference between a common robber band and a government, according to Augustine. Well, in Mexico, you got a perfect example of that because the robbers are the government. There is no daylight between the two of them. So when the federal government sends billions of dollars into Mexico to fight narcotics, you got to figure that probably something on the high end of half of that is going to end up in the hands of the same narcotics cartels or in the hands of people who are cheek by jowl allies of the narcotics cartels. At the same time, you got Wachovia laundering the money. Now, what happened is that there are these currency exchange institutions called Casas de Cambio, or CDCs. They're currency exchanges run without scrutiny or oversight by the Mexican government. When I was in Mexico, I used to go to the Casas de Cambio because you could get a better exchange rate for your dollars in terms of the difference between the dollars and the pesos when you're in Mexico. I wasn't crazy enough at the time, and granted, this is 25 years ago or more. I wasn't crazy enough at the time to go to CDCs that were run by people who were obviously in the pockets of the drug gangs, but you'd go to one of these and you get a better rate than you would if you went to a bank. The Casas de Cambio also have another advantage in that they're opaque. Their dealings are not transparent. But this is complicated because they don't really have a working relationship with many reputable banks in the United States. But Wachovia was one that was willing to give them some help. These Casas de Cambio would set up what were called complementary accounts, particularly in Miami. There were a number of Wachovia accounts in Miami that were being used by these Mexican CDCs, these Casas de Cambio. And the money would be sent through Wachovia, be cleaned, pressed, and folded, and then used to buy drugs wholesale or to buy jets to carry the drugs into the United States, to ferry the drugs into the United States. And they did this to the tune of at least $300 billion, probably something on the high end of $500 billion to be a better estimate. And they're getting not merely a slap on the wrist, they're getting the lightest of all possible slaps on the wrist for this, while people like Johnny Gaskins go to prison.
Are you suggesting that there's some inequality in the court program? Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with William Grieg. But ladies and gentlemen, we have lost our moral foundation in this country. We have simply just torn the very heart out of what was once a great Christian nation. And can this nation long survive when we have immorality at every level of government and the court system? Bye. Well, William, you go right ahead.
You make, of course, the most important point here, which is that this whole situation we're describing here, this unambiguous and brazen lack of equity and the system-wide full-spectrum injustice where you have people like Johnny Gaskins going to prison for doing nothing and criminals of the sort running Wachovia who are being embraced and cosseted by the establishment, that does reflect the complete breakdown of our moral values and the fact that we're not living according to the two great commandments, the golden rule, and people are content to believe that really there is no restraint on people apart from power. I mean, whether you have power or not, this is Lenin's equation. The key equation is who does what to whom. You want to be the who rather than the whom. Whether or not you have power, whether or not you have power is the deciding question in terms of whether you're going to have your backside kissed or you're going to get stabbed in the back. It's that blunt, it's that obvious, and it's that evil, and it's not getting better anytime soon. One of the things I'm hoping is that as the system collapses, and it is collapsing in real time right now, and when Paul Krugman and his ilk admitted, we know that that's true, that this is a correction that will bring about the moral renaissance of our country. I mean, they don't call it a correction for nothing, as Lou Rockwell likes to say. One of the things that happens, of course, when you have a boom is it's completely propelled by fraud. People are inured to taking advantage of each other and living at the expense of others rather than doing equity. I'm hoping that one of the benefits that will come out of the tragedy that's beginning to descend on us is that we'll recover, we'll restore just this fundamental understanding of the golden rule. You know, you will do unto others as you wish to be done to. And that's, of course, the most important recovery that we have in order for our economy to recover, in order for our politics to be restored to some kind of a moral footing. You know, it all starts with a question of recognizing the reciprocal nature of rights, that your rights exist in exactly the same way that everybody else's does, and that everybody else's is valued by his creator as you are. And for that reason, the only protection you have for what you wish to do with your rights, your life, your property that you're given, is to protect on a reciprocal basis the rights of others. I'm hoping that's going to happen. Maybe it won't happen nationwide. Maybe it'll happen in little isolated pockets of our country. But
hold that thought, William. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William is just saying that we are moving into terrible times. Our whole economic system is collapsing, and even Paul Krugman, who has been an optimist up until the present time, has said within this last week, we're heading into a deflationary depression, which, of course, is a terrible situation. And, of course, it means that the whole economic system begins to implode. Now, William makes the point, you know, that on the other end of this, this may be a great and wonderful thing that we may be able then to have a renaissance of freedom and idealism coming out of the far end of this terrible period we're moving into. And there really are two alternatives. One is that there will be a renaissance of freedom, or the other will be that freedom as we know it will simply become a remembrance of things past, a remembrance of things past, and we will be living in a terrible and brutal tyranny. And really, I believe the solution to the problem, of course, is a return to God, a renaissance in our religious beliefs. Only then will God bless this nation. Otherwise, he is going to destroy this nation, and America as we know it will cease to exist. Well, before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get your blog site, how they can hear your radio program, and how they can find that PayPal button, which will help keep you here on the Radio Liberty on a regular basis. Go right ahead.
Really appreciate that. My blog, Pro Libertate, is at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or just go to Google and type in Grig and Pro Libertate. That should be the first result, or at least one of the first several results that will be coughed up by Google. freedominourtime.blogspot.com or Grig and Pro Libertate, LIBERTATE. The radio program is also called Pro Libertate, Pro Libertate Radio. It's broadcast every Saturday night from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time, which is the time zone where I live, or 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock California time. on the Liberty News Radio Network. LibertyNewsRadio.com is the website, the homepage for Liberty News Radio, LibertyNewsRadio.com. If you go to LibertyNewsRadio.com, your listeners will be able to find a list of local affiliates. We are on a number of stations scattered across the country, and I do believe that the radio network is still growing. And also the program is available by way of live streaming. If you have capacity to listen to something on your computer, you're going to find a streaming program, an option on the Liberty News Radio website that will be suitable, because there are probably a dozen or so options. And also the programs are archived. You can download them as podcasts. LibertyNewsRadio.com. You'd mentioned, Dr. Stan, that I do have a PayPal button for those who have access to PayPal, or those who have credit card, debit card, and have the means and interest of donating. It is found at the bottom of every essay at Pro Libertate. That's once again freedominourtime.blogspot.com or Grig plus Pro Libertate at Google. And that is located once again at the bottom of every essay. And that is, as you point out, the way that I'm supporting myself, my family, and what I do as a freelance journalist. And it's been a real blessing that I've been able to talk to you and talk to your audience, because many people in your audience have been extremely generous to us, and that's something that I'll always be grateful for, is the wonderful generosity of your terrific audience. So once again, that's the bottom of every essay at Pro Libertate, the blog, freedominourtime.blogspot.com.
And I would just mention that things have been a little tight recently, I think, for many ministries. But I sort of, we want to keep William here. He's doing a wonderful job. He's got a lot of responsibilities with six children or so. And anyway, if you can possibly help him, why, we would encourage you to do that. And certainly we believe very much in what he's doing. We think he's doing a wonderful job. We think he's one of the most articulate spokesmen we have for the cause of freedom. And so let's get back to the current situation that America is facing, as you give us the cheerful proposition that we're moving into a period of chaos and crisis. But I think people have to understand that. I think that people have to understand that you can't spend yourself into prosperity, that the whole economy of the United States is beginning to implode. The economy of China is beginning to implode. They've had a 25% drop in their stock market over the last couple of months. They've got 30 million people unemployed. Their banking system is having very real problems, because they've got all these loans that will never be paid back. And similarly, problems are occurring over in Europe, certainly in Southern Europe. And we have to only to watch the Baltic Dry Index. That is the index, yeah, certainly of shipping and the cost of shipping. And it is plummeting. Why? Because there's very little shipping going on between nations, because trade is beginning to implode. And, of course, this will have a profound impact here in America, despite what President Obama says, is that things are getting better. Go right ahead.
It's really an interesting thing when you see people describing what amounts to an economic autoimmune disease and its symptoms as signs of health and recovery. And that's exactly what we're talking about right now. When we have an economy that doesn't produce anything, you can't be wealthy unless you produce. You have to produce something that other people want and other people are willing to pay for, whether you're talking about offering a product that is the end result of your applied labor mixed with property, or that you're talking about rendering a service that other people feel desirable. Only by providing these things can you actually earn money and in that way help the economy to grow. Just a couple of days ago, I had a conversation with somebody I love dearly. I just think the world of this person. I honestly, it would be hard-pressed to find somebody for whom I have greater respect and affection. And what he said to me was, this economy isn't going to get any better until they start instituting programs that put people back to work. And I had to stop for a second, and after stepping on my tongue and retracting my tongue back to my mouth so I could speak, I said, well, you see, that's exactly why we're in the mess we're in right now, is the assumption that somehow government can transmute debt into wealth by simply ordaining that people go to work, and it can somehow create wealth out of the ether, it can somehow create money and capital out of the ether, and that the origin of wealth is when you mix force and fraud with stolen property, and that somehow that's going to result in wealth. I said, the problem isn't that government isn't creating programs to put people back to work. The problem is that government's destroying the productive economy, productive capacity of our economy, in order to take political control over the means of production. And that's not something that is amenable to the remedy you're describing here. You're talking about essentially trying to cure cancer by giving somebody AIDS on top of the cancer. But every time we take a look at the incomplete and deliberately misleading statistics and indices that the government publishes about the economy, we see the same trend line. We see that the private sector, what remains of it, is shedding jobs, and that the government sector is creating jobs that don't create wealth. There's a terrific piece, by terrific I mean terrifying, at theexaminer.com, the Washington Examiner, by Timothy P. Carey, that talks about a visit by Vice President Biden to a General Electric factory in Kentucky. Mr. Biden he's really a useful and worthwhile individual in that he says things that are so staggeringly stupid that they force you to pay attention to the assumptions that produce the stupidity in question. I mean, he's perpetually speaking, and he's saying foolish things, but if you grab the foolishness and you sort of trace it back to its origin, you can see just how wrong-headed and how deeply embedded these assumptions are. This is what Mr. Biden told this crowd at the General Electric factory in Louisville, Appliance Park in Louisville. So those who talk about this is big government giving a little help, a little bit of help to jumpstart America, to lead the world in the 21st century. Timothy B. Carney, comments as follows. Biden was at GE's Appliance Park in Louisville, where a raft of government subsidies and probably some gentle urging from the White House has spurred the multinational conglomerate to begin manufacturing hybrid electric water heaters, part of the new foundation for the new economy, Biden said. But later this month, 75 miles east, workers at GE's Kentucky Glass plant get to see the other side of big government. About 175 workers there make glass, which is shipped to the Winchester Bulb plant. Winchester Bulb is being shut down in September, and so the Lexington Glass plant will be shuttered in late July. GE explained in a press release late last year, quote, a variety of energy regulations that establish lighting efficiency standards are being implemented in the U.S. and other countries, in some cases this year, and will soon make the familiar lighting products produced at the Winchester plant obsolete. These were green regulations that then-Senator Obama supported in the 2007 energy bill, as did GE. GE, incidentally, is not a free market company. It is completely wedded to the military-industrial complex. Like too many corporations, it's run by people who are representatives of what Adam Smith called the band of system. That's a personality who prospers by cozying up to political power rather than going out and making his fortune actually in the private sector. To continue, GE, the company you see, makes more profit off the more efficient compact fluorescent bulbs because the company can charge more, but also because it makes those bulbs in China with cheaper labor costs and fewer environmental regulations. So Obama and GE teamed up, pushed big government environmental regs and killed nearly 500 jobs in Lexington, Winchester, and another glass factory in Niles, Ohio. But don't worry, Obama's got an answer for these workers, too. Obama's Labor Department this spring declared the plant an adversely affected employer under the 1974 Trade Act. It's true, imports are replacing the bulbs Lexington workers used to make, but the culprit isn't free trade, it's the light bulb law. And these imports are GE's compact fluorescents, the ones made in China, remember. Back to Louisville, where Biden is touting the benefits of big government, the picture is far murkier. It's true Congress and the administration have opened the spout of corporate welfare for GE in order to keep jobs in Louisville, $24.8 million in advanced manufacturing tax credits from the stimulus, plus up to $17 million in incentives from the state and metro government, according to a GE press release. These water heater jobs are largely replacing lost refrigerator jobs, which brings us back to big government, although Obama bears no blame in this one. In July 2000, the U.S. Export-Import Bank, now let me just stop here for a second and interpolate something necessary and germane here. The Export-Import Bank was created back during the New Deal for the specific original intention of underwriting trade with Soviet Russia in order to preserve that regime. That was why export-import was created. It has since branched out and has played a major role, and this is something I wrote about in my book about 6 years ago called America's Engineered Decline. It has played a major role in strip mining, the subsidized strip mining of our industrial economy. In July 2000, to continue with Carney's column here, the U.S. Export-Import Bank, a government agency, subsidized GE's construction of a factory complex in Celaya, Mexico. That complex makes GE refrigerators, fridges that used to be made in the United States. To be fair, the EXIM subsidy exported the jobs making high-end fridges, while Appliance Park made low-end fridges. So EXIM helped kill GE jobs in Bloomington, Indiana, rather than in Lexington. So big government policies are killing GE jobs that might thrive in the free market, while creating GE jobs that never would survive in a free market. Obama is replacing unsubsidized jobs with subsidized jobs. Biden, back to that blatherskite, Biden calls this a new economy. Obama calls it remaking America. GE Chief Executive Officer Jeff Immelt calls this relationship capitalism reset. Immelt wrote to shareholders days after Obama's inauguration, quote, "The interaction between government and business will change forever. In a reset economy, the government will be a regulator and also an industry policy champion, a financier, and a key partner."
But, of course, the problem is this. When you're having to borrow $5 billion a day to be able to subsidize GE and maintain our wars and you give out all this money to unemployed people who don't want to go to work, because why should they go to work and they get $1,200 a month simply for sitting on their rear ends and then food stamps and free health care and all the other benefits you get when you're unemployed? You know, why would you bother to go to work? And so we have several million people getting unemployment insurance, but what happens when you run out of money? I mean, are we going to give it to the unemployed? Are we going to give it to General Electric and other people who are part of the establishment that put Obama in office? And then what about the money that we've been giving to the people in Uganda to provide medication for the people of AIDS over there? And what about the billions of dollars we're sending over to Iraq to build their electric plants? Of course, that was 6 years after the war, while you still only have electricity about 1 hour a day there in Baghdad, if you are lucky, but go right ahead. I mean, how long can we continue, you know, rebuilding Afghanistan? How long can we continue rebuilding Iraq? And won't we have to rebuild Iran after we bombed it and destroyed many of their major cities? But go right ahead.
Well, one of the reasons why I talk so much about things like this Wachovia scandal is because these are the things that are being laid bare as the bubble bursts and the floodwaters of phony liquidity recede. They're actually being gathered up, of course, by these same banking institutions, and this is exactly what happened about a century ago in change that led to the revolution of 1913 and the revolution of 1917. It's interesting to see what's going to come out of this. But one of the reasons I'm talking about this is because it's important for people to understand exactly how they have gone about doing this, exactly what are, if you will, sort of the substructural deals that have been struck that have created this architecture of official criminality. And, of course, what Mr. Immelt at GE is talking about when he talks about government and business being in a partnership, he's talking about fascism. He's talking about what Lenin called the new economic policy, what Mussolini called the corporate state. FDR, of course, in his administration, took their blueprint for the first New Deal right out of the writings of Giovanni Gentile and the other chief architects of the fascist economy. And now, 70-some-odd years later, we're seeing under Obama the same thing making a quantum leap forward, but he's building, just as importantly, on the work of his immediate predecessor. The thing is that the Republicans don't mind corporate socialism as long as you're building the military-industrial complex, the warfare half of the welfare warfare state, and now you'd have to call it the welfare warfare, homeland security, torture, prison system, the welfare warfare penological complex. And as long as you're building the coercive element of government, most Republican conservatives, I emphasize most, there are some worthwhile exceptions, don't have any problem with that, whereas, of course, the Obamatrons, people from that element, think that it's just wonderful that you use those elements of coercion, those instruments of coercion, in order to build what they call social justice, which, of course, entails the wholesale transfer of wealth from the productive into the hands of the parasitical, the unions, particularly government employee unions and such like. And this all, of course, once again, goes back to the constant theme that you reiterate, Dr. Stan, that is that all this constitutes a cluster of symptoms of one fundamental disease, and that people are no longer governed by rudimentary morality. They no longer understand or respect the idea of the golden rule. They no longer understand or are bound by the idea of the two great commandments, the need to love your neighbor as yourself. These are things that we've lost, and we have to regain them in a hurry.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William. Well, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Thanks, Dr. Stan. Once again, thanks so much for this opportunity. It's a real blessing. And in spite of everything, I hope you have a wonderful Independence Day, and I wish the same for your wonderful and valued listeners. This is still a country we're celebrating, although the government that slicks us is not. I think that we can take a lot of comfort and strength from the example of the forebears who waged a desperate and apparently futile battle to secede, to withdraw from a globe-spanning empire, and to interpose themselves against the iniquitous dealings of a government that had grown corrupt and presumptuous. And I think that that's the message that we have to take away from Independence Day. Too often, of course, it's going to be celebrated in terms of reveling in the majesty, the depraved majesty, and supposed glory of government as an instrument of compulsion. We're going to be talking about the virtues of military might, about the notion that America is great and wonderful because we have a military that straddles the globe. The thing is, we should be celebrating what a handful of incorrigible Christian fundamentalist anti-government radicals did, and what the common people did as well. We hear a lot about the marquee figures from the drive for independence. They're properly celebrated. They did some wonderful things. But don't forget the fact that you had a literate and motivated and largely moral population that understood the principles of liberty. They understood the need for government to be ruled by God's law. And they were the ones who made the sacrifices and paid the price. Granted, the signers of the Declaration of Independence paid terrible prices as well. Many of them paid a terrible price. But take a look at the common man, the common women who were willing in large numbers to do the really heavy and less than glamorous work of the war for independence. They're the people really we really need to look to and whose example we can profit from in the times that confront us right now. And I do hope that we're approaching a revolutionary moment where people are going to recover and restore that heritage that cost so dearly so long ago, and that can provide us even today with inspiration and strength and motivation.
Well, we're moving into a period, really, that is going to determine the future of America, the future of the world. And certainly behind all of this, I think there are powerful spiritual forces. We are so privileged to live at this time of history and to know the Lord. William, I want you to know how much I appreciate you being with us, and we'll talk to you next week. I think it's going to be on Thursday, and then, of course, you'll be back here on our regular Friday, and we hope, after next week.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. God bless.
God bless you, too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, and we'll be back in just a moment with William Craig. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope you enjoy our weekly program with William, and certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope he's yours as well. But this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. We look to you out there across America, indeed across the world. If you're in a position to help us financially, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, and you can join the Radio Liberty family of supporters or subscribe to our newsletter, whatever you feel called to do. And if you're not in a position to help and you agree with us, why, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And let me simply mention some of the things we have. We have a wonderful DVD. It's called God's Wonders. And it simply shows you the magnificent pictures of flowers and butterflies and animals and simply how did they come about. There has to be some sort of a design for them. And then we go into background of DNA, and of course the ultimate conclusion is there has to be some sort of a designer for all of these things. If there's designer, there's got to be some supernatural force behind it. Would we call it God? Well, anyway, it's a wonderful DVD. I promise you, you'll feel inspired when you see it, called God's Wonders. And then, of course, we have that a great 10-DVD set put out by Pastor Billy Crone, The Final Countdown, and goes into the prophecies that we see being fulfilled literally every day. And there's a book that goes with that. You can get the 10 DVDs, part 1, part 2, or you can get them all together. And then, of course, we suggest the book if you'd like to actually have it written there and you can go over it. And then you can talk to others about how we are seeing prophecy fulfilled. We have offer something. It's called Newell Oler's CDs, the piano of programs are probably 6 or 8 songs on every CD. And these are the most beautiful songs. Newell had a wonderful, wonderful talent, and we had a chance to meet him. Barbara and I, we went down to Texas and spent a part of an afternoon with him. But this music is something you'll really enjoy. Now, if you just ask for it, we'll send you a free sample. And then, of course, if you like, well, you can get the complete set or any one of the DVDs you want to. But they're well worthwhile having something that will give you an uplift in times like this, when sometimes we need some encouragement, something that will bring a smile to our face. And then, of course, we do hope many of you will certainly go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and listen to our programs. You can listen there 9 hours a day on the Internet, satellite uplink. And then, of course, we hope you'll tell others about Radio Liberty and try to explain to them what's going on. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to read it through 6 times to really understand what's going on today. Because there really is a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. There really were 2 forces in the United States when this nation was formed. One the Christian, the other the occult. And this is what's never taught in our churches today. We have a wonderful set of DVDs. It's called the Secret Mystery Series, and I play a small part in each one, quite inconsequential, other than some of the ideas we put forward, which I think helped to shape this very important series. And if you would like to get them, you can get them separately. The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, and of course, the Eye of the Phoenix goes into the occult emblem on the back of the dollar bill. What's an occult emblem doing on the back of the dollar bill? Why, ladies and gentlemen, you will see them every place. The Statue of Liberty was actually a Masonic statue presented by the French Masonic lodges to the Freemasons here in the United States to celebrate not the liberty that we celebrate, but the libertinism of the French Revolution, where they took a prostitute and put her on the altar at the great cathedral there in Paris, Notre Dame. Understand that there are powerful spiritual forces. We're involved in that battle whether we want to or not. I number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty.